the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Now to a real high flyer in the arts industry, as the festival season is upon us, we're joined by a woman who is a leading light in that world. Mary Hickson has run festivals both here and internationally for years. She collaborates with artists, actors and musicians, the likes of Cillian Murphy, The National, Bon Iver and many more. Mary, you're very welcome. But before we get to all of that, just your own background. I know you're from Fermoy, but you spent a few years as a kid living over a pub that your mam inherited from her aunt, Cahir's in Corrafin. Do you still have memories of that?
I have. Like, the bar was like steeped in traditional Irish music. It definitely like began my love of music. My bedroom was over the pub, so I'd be listening to tunes late into the night trying to go to sleep. And I have a very, very vivid memory of, at the time I was Irish dancing. I think everyone my generation at the time was Irish dancing. But I remember a tune, someone starting a tune that I had just learned to, it was a jigger reel, I can't remember, but I just learned to dance to that tune. And I was like, right, this is my moment. I got out of the bed, down the stairs, out the front door of the house, in the front door of the pub, and found a spot in the bar where my mother wouldn't see me. And I started throwing shapes. I danced whatever I had learned to a very, very, very enthusiastic audience. And at the end, without even blinking, I pulled up the corners of my nightie and started collecting money. And I was gone out the door, back in the front door, up in the bed and like admiring my loot without anyone noticing. I did it a couple of times until I got caught and I got reddened for it. But
well, you were cute enough to know that your mother was not going to be pleased to hide, and then cute enough to say, I might as well get some money out of it as well as the performance.
I know. I don't know where it came from, but
did you make much?
I can't remember how much I made, but I remember admiring it. I don't know if I could even count money at the time, but I remember looking at it in the bed going, God, I could break away now and start my own life, you know.
Bit of shiny silver or copper.
Stout soaked copper. Yeah, that's what it was.
Music then, it's interesting how at such an early age you recall the sounds of traditional Irish music coming up through the bar, and that really became a deep love of yours, music in general, not just traditional Irish music. And it was something then that stayed with you throughout your teens.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's definitely something with hindsight I can look back and see the moments of connection. But at the time, it wasn't very conscious, do you know what I mean? Like, my love of traditional Irish music kind of went away for a while. And when it came back, it was so familiar to me that it was in that moment that I was like, oh, now I can understand that all that time in the bar, sleeping over the pub, listening to the likes of Tommy Peoples and Noel Hill and all the greats really were playing downstairs. Like, what an experience.
Well, sneaking down to do the bit of dancing suggested a bit of rebelliousness or independence at an early age. Were you a fiery enough kid, and did that continue on through your teenage years?
I would say I was fiery at that age, and then I got very, very, very quiet. It was very deep thinking. I'd be playing the piano a lot, and I was playing the violin as well. I'd spend an awful lot of time just immersed in my studies for like proper grade exams. But I was a bit of a loner, I'd say. I would definitely...
Why a loner, do you think?
I don't know. I used to line my bedroom wall and like do these massive big calligraphy projects all over my wall. I'd spend months and months, desiderato, footprints in the sand, that kind of crack. Absolutely.
Better than wallpaper.
I mean, it was. And then I'd paint the wall. When I'd finish it, I'd go, God, that's lovely. And I'd paint it and do another one. I'd be months in there. I suppose there are those moments of incubation, I guess, just kind of without acknowledging at the time. I suppose I was just trying to figure out who I was and what I was going to do with my life. And
you wanted to study music in college. How did your parents feel about that?
Oh gosh, that was a very contentious thing. And again, with hindsight, I can see now that I have, like, my son just finished the leaving and we're in that CAO conversation. I understand now that my parents just wanted to be sure that I was, you know, working towards a career that would keep me for my life. And I was like, I want to do music. And my father was like, don't be ridiculous. Like, nobody does music. And he's like, you'll be a teacher. Everyone in my family's a teacher. You'll be a teacher. And I was like, I had no desire to be a teacher. So there was a massive argument. When the CAO change of mind came, there was a massive argument about, because I couldn't do music in a straight BA. But if I did a BA Mus, I could have music as a subject. So I was doing the BA Mus then, which was a 3-year degree, and I was doing maths and psychology. And I had no, and I hadn't even an, I the smallest interest in maths or psychology. It was all about the music, and I was having this real expansive experience in the music department. And I was coming up to my 3rd year, my final exams, and I used to go home every weekend. I worked in a factory in Fermoy to pay my rent. I worked in the kitchen there. And I'd call in home and I'd see my parents. And I dropped in anyway, and I was called into the front room, which is never a good thing, of course. You know, you're in trouble if you're in the front room. So I was called in. My dad was sitting on the chair and he's like, oh, I got a call earlier in the week from your professor. And I was like, oh Jesus, what am I after doing or not doing? Like, I'm in trouble. But he called to say that he'd gotten permission from the Dean of Arts for me to transfer to a BMus, and I hadn't put him up to it. I hadn't asked him to do this for me. And the words are coming out of my father's mouth, and I'm like, oh my God, like all of my prayers were answered in that moment. And he was like, did you put him up to it? Like, what's all this about? But because Professor Cox took that initiative and made that call and had set it all up, we didn't have to do anything. There was no administration, there was no fees, it was all covered. Everything was like, it was an easy sail over to music. He's like, she's got great potential. She's wasted doing the maths and the psychology. Like, you just got to get behind her,
So it was just pure music
and
after
just
that.
believe that this is her world, and she can transfer straight over. One of the most important moments in my life. It totally changed everything. So I remember the next morning running into his office and throwing myself on him, like with gratitude, because I genuinely hadn't asked him to do that for me. Like, he was such an incredible, insightful, intuitive person that he took it on himself and literally made my dreams come true.
Were they good years in Cork when you were studying and working there, and all the freedom and the
Unbelievable.
college scene that that brings?
Yeah, I was so fulfilled. Like, I was playing music morning, noon, and night. And when I wasn't doing that, I was pulling pints in either the Opera House, the Half Moon, or the Bodega, or the lobby bar as well. Like, so I was socializing, but I was on the safe side of the bar. I was in the room with the pals without drinking the pints. Not to say that I didn't drink the pints too, but like, I was mostly pulling the pints.
One of the people that you would have been throwing out a couple of pints to at that time was Cillian Murphy, the
Yeah.
Oscar-winning actor, and you would have known him from earlier years.
Yeah, Kill and my parents were good friends right up until the end. Like, sadly, I lost my dad last year and my mother passed away a couple of years ago. But Brendan and Mary were good friends with my parents. So we would have kind of been around each other, but we didn't become very good friends until it was after we brought Ballyturk to the Opera House when I was the CEO there during my tenure. Like, I remember my very first day stepping through the door, and I wrote a list, you know, the dream list, the fantasy list of who might thread the boards while I was running the Opera House. And Cillian was up there front and center. And it was a really big moment for both he and I and our parents when Ballyturk came to the Opera House. And there was just something about us at the time. Like, we were always familiar with each other, like, as you say, back in the day. When he was in Sons of Mr. Green Jeans, which was the band before he became an actor, I was pulling pints. So we were in the small room together an awful lot and like hanging out. But
Did you give him any free pints? No.
I would, of course. Yeah, the band always got free pints.
Right.
that's important. Keep the artists happy.
And you're still very good friends with him. You would have gone over to the Oscars with him and everything.
We reconnected and like stayed close ever since, and we're very, very, very good friends. Like, we'd probably be in touch every day.
A young Cillian Murphy at that time, what was he like? I mean, the impression, you get from the outside is of him a brilliant actor who can take on so many different roles, but a fairly quiet, understated kind of guy. Is that what he was like?
Yeah, it's funny. It's the quiet ones you got to watch, you know. I mean, the kind of dedication to the band was always so impressive. Like, they were always really, like, they gave everything to that band. So the sense of, like, commitment to process and practice was there and very evident at that time, before he ever did Disco Pigs.
But you do have to watch The Quiet Ones.
Yeah.
Does that include yourself?
I mean, I have a friend, actually, when I was working at the bodega, and I met his mother, my friend Stephen, and his mother came in one day and we were all hanging out. And she said to him that night, she's like, "She's watch that one now, watch her." I remember that. That definitely stood out. And I was like, what did she mean? You know, but he reminded me a couple of years later, and she's like, he said, like, "Oh, she was right. Keep an eye. This is The Quiet Ones."
Well, you went to Dublin then after that. There was an opportunity to go and work at a world music event.
Well, it was, yeah, an acceptable term at the time. What happened was I finished my BMUS and I got a scholarship to do a master's in ethnomusicology in Limerick. And while I was there, I can't remember who, but it was probably Micheál O'Sullivan mentioned that this world music festival was about to start in Dublin. And again, you know, I just had this feeling in my body, in my gut, and I packed my bag and I slept under my sister's dining room table. I got a job in Trident Holiday Homes to pay my way until I discovered who was running this festival. Like, I went on a rumor. An event 3 months later, after selling holiday homes to beat the band, I figured out it was Dunleary Rathdown County Council, and I hounded poor Sarah Searson, who was the arts officer at the time, to give me a job. And fair play to her, she took a risk. It was my first job. I hadn't a notion what I was doing, but I convinced her that I did. And I convinced myself too that I did. And like, the idea of a meeting at the time was like mind blowing. Literally, I was like, I have a meeting today.
I'm sure that didn't last long.
Oh, it didn't. Yeah, sure. Look, working out of a disused hairdressing salon in Monkstown, like, it was super classy.
But also, it was introducing you to the whole other reality of the business and the organisation of events, because there's a huge creative process, but there's an awful lot of nuts and bolts and organising and planning and fairly mundane stuff too.
I mean, it doesn't continue if it doesn't make sense financially, you know. So every step along the way, you have to consider why you're spending what you're spending. And most of the projects that I would have worked on and have and still work on in Ireland are funded by the state. So you have to really consider every minute that you're spending, every penny that you're spending. Like, I remember at the time feeling like that responsibility was always very heavy on me, and kind of going, okay, am I okay with my father's tax being funding this, or my uncle's tax, or my sister's tax? You know, you have to really consider, would they get behind this as an idea? And is this just reckless? You know, it's like, it's
very conscientious of you, Mary.
Yeah, not all of it was successful either. You know, you have to kind of make your mistakes and find your way and figure it out, you know.
And you applied, you saw a job for as chief executive of the Corp Opera House, and you said you just applied for that job, you just saw it.
I was in the pub having a pint with a very dear friend, Olga Barry, who runs Kilkenny Arts Festival, and she went to the loo, and there was a Cork Examiner, it was called at the time, sitting on the table, and I just flicked, just to be seen to be doing something, like, I wasn't reading the paper at all, just flicking through the paper, and there's this half-page ad for CEO of Cork Opera House. And instantly I was like, okay, that's it. That's next. And without a shadow of a doubt, my whole body was like, I'm going to do that job. And Olga came back from the loo and I was like, I'm going to apply for that job. And she's like, and you should.
And it hadn't been going well. So this was a real
turnaround
job. It had been
close.
But did you obviously had a lot of confidence in going for the job, because you wouldn't have had that much experience. What did your mom and dad think?
I rang my mother to tell her I was out throwing my hat in the ring, and her, without a breath, she was like, why would you put yourself through that disappointment? Like, I remember clocking that sentence and going, I'm just going to put that somewhere. I'm going to engrave it because it is a thing I need to revisit in the future. But there was no resentment, or I wasn't angry with her, or I don't remember having any bad feeling towards it. But I was just like, that's very interesting that that's what you'll say. But it didn't deter me. I was like, I'm doing this.
What was it like going in there and turning things around and doing things differently and bringing a new energy to it? Because it hadn't been all that long ago at that stage that, that you had been working behind the bar there?
Yeah, I think it was something like 11 or 12 years since I'd worked there. But when I worked there when I was in college, I maybe did 3 or 4 years. Like, I was there for quite a long time and I was doing many, many, many shifts a week. So like...
Were some of the staff still there when you came in as chief executive?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So when the first time I came through the door and I remember seeing all these familiar faces and you could see them all going, it's you. Like, we heard the name, but we assumed it wouldn't be you. Like, the crack we used to have together. And we did. We ended up having a lot of fun together while I was the CEO as well. But I remember walking the building, meeting everybody, and then closing the office door and being like, oh my God, where am I going to start?
What was it like working with the board? Were they on side with everything you wanted to do?
I mean, ultimately everything happened and we turned it around together. Like, we, in the first 6 months, we had 70,000 first-time bookers in Cork City. Like, my, you know, that first day I was like, it's Cork Opera House, but does it feel like it's Cork's Opera House? Like, does Cork, or everyone in Cork feel like it's their place? And at the time, I would say they didn't. It was programming to a very specific demographic. And I had to just blow that up and go, okay, let's get Peppa Pig. Like, let's get the Wiggles. Let's get the Gruffalo. Let's get the kids coming in here for something other than Panto every year. So it becomes part of their life. It becomes habitual that they engage with the theater because you need to get them in young, you know? So we had to really diversify the program, stick our neck out creatively.
And it worked.
It worked. I mean, yeah, we turned its first profit in its existence in like its 160 years. And we held it for my tenure.
You were the first female CEO and the youngest.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was 35 when I started, 40 when I finished. I suppose there was this determination and drive to do it because everyone was saying it was a poison chalice that couldn't be done. And that was red rag to a bull. I was like, give it to me. Give me the 5 years. But I knew I couldn't stay beyond that. I just needed to broaden my wings and look outside of Cork, like look outside of Ireland, start making bigger projects around the world.
I noticed that every time somebody says or intimates to you that you might not be able to do something, you really seem to dig in and want to make it happen all the more.
Yeah, sure. Look, don't be setting me any challenges there now, because I'll have to go after them.
After the Opera House, you've been involved in so many different projects. I mean, one of them, for example, what started out as the People in Berlin, where yeah. you got 180 artists together yeah. for a week and they have to come up with a performance at the end of it.
Yeah. So one of the last projects I did in my time as CEO in Cork Opera House was a festival called Sounds from a Safe Harbour. And I did that with Bryce Dessner from The National. And we took over the city of Cork. We had 45 venues and any number of artists playing and collaborating. Collaboration was at the core. And then that was 2015. In 2016, Bryce was involved in curating this happening in Berlin. It wasn't called People yet. It was just like an experience that Bryce and Aaron Dessner from The National, Bon Iver, Michel Berger Hotel, they all decided that they would invite artists to come and live at the hotel and work out of the Funkhaus, which is this beautiful disused radio center in Berlin. And at the end, we would show what was made in a 2-day festival. I think 5,000 or 6,000 people came through.
Where did the connection with The National and Bryce Dessner come from?
So how did that happen? Back in 2011, while I was at the Opera House, I was always and still am a huge Steve Reich fan. And I had read about a new commission that Steve had written for two guitars. It was called 2x5 and Bryce Dessner. And I think it was Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead were performing it. So I slid into his Facebook DMs, which was a real classy thing to do at the time. And I asked him, was there any chance he would be around and available to come to Cork? And he responded, which was like mind blowing. Unfortunately, he wasn't available, but he's like, let's meet when I'm next in Cork. And I was like, when are The National ever going to be in Cork? Like, despite my best efforts.
They're from Cincinnati and they're touring all over the world. Isn't that really?
That's right. But like they were playing to much bigger houses than Cork Opera House at the time and still are. Sure, they're after exploding even more. But sure enough, the Marquee programmed them in 2013 and Bryce email saying, do you want to meet for a cup of tea? And I was like, oh my God. I was so nervous. I was so anxious walking up to Hayfield Manor. I thought I was going to throw up in the ditch. But he said he'd 20 minutes, and 3 hours later he'd missed his sound check, and we had decided we were going to do Sounds from a Safe Harbor together. So that's where this this community of collaborators began.
You also produced Kagami, which is described as a mixed reality concert, and it's all around the late Ryushi Sakamoto, the composer.
This was another one of those light bulb moments where I heard another rumor, right? It's the same thing about packing my bag, going to Dublin. I heard a rumor that Ryuichi had said about leaving a fully dimensional piano recital beyond his life. And at the time he had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. So I was like, what a beautiful way to engage with technology. Like, I had been struggling with why and how, and I'm such a tactile person that the in real life experience felt like the world I should only be in. But when you hear about why, the motivation behind leaving a fully dimensional performance, knowing that you're going to die, I was like, I want to be part of that. So I'm sitting at my kitchen table in Cork going, how in the name of God is this going to happen? And it was 3 months later, I was on the job, but it all happened by weird coincidence. Like, somebody introduced me to someone. And it was just a mad, mad experience. I'll tell you the story. I was in a meeting in Pioneer Works in Red Hook in Brooklyn, New York. And the director there, we were talking about a project that we were going to be doing together. And he was mid-sentence and he just turned his head and went, do you know Todd Eckert? And I was like, no, never heard of him. And he's like, I just feel compelled to connect you. So he went, Todd, Mary, Todd, have fun. And that was it. And we went back to our conversation. And 2 weeks later, Todd sent a message going, Gabe's never introduced me to anyone. There's obviously something here for us to explore. And we had a Zoom. He was in Pittsburgh. I was in Cork. Turns out he was the director of the Ryuichi Sakamoto project, which became Kagami. But it was very sad in that he passed away just after we announced the show. He wasn't around for the premiere in New York. And it made it all the more poignant, and his wife, Narika, came with these ashes the day that we launched. It was in the shed in Hudson Yards. And yeah, it's touring the world now. The next presentation will be in Italy in August.
When you look at how things have gone for you and how you became involved in different projects, do you believe in coincidence? Or do you think that 100%. You make things happen as well? It couldn't be coincidence on its own.
I know, and a couple of people have said that it's not all coincidence, you put it out and you get it back, but there's just been too many, that one with Sakamoto, that was, I did for the very first time, a couple of weeks before I had that call with Todd and I had that meeting with Gabe, I had never tried to visualize or manifest something, and I meditated. I sound like total woo-woo now. But I did. I sat in the sitting room and I sent the energy out. I was like, I really want to work on that Sakamoto project. So I don't know that anything I had, obviously getting the job, the work I had done in my career brought me to that moment professionally. But there was something else that made the connection with Todd. I do believe that.
If you look back, Mary, on all the things you've done and also the people and the creative people that you have met, any particular cultural moments, what would you say are your favourites where you said, oh, that was really, really great to be there or to be part of that?
Oh, yikes. God, that's really hard. At a Primavera a couple of years ago, I went there to do a people talk with Aaron Dessner, and he and Bon Iver, Justin Vernon, have a band called Big Red Machine. And they were playing the main stage to 25,000 people. And I went to the loo, but I could still hear the stage. And Aaron started talking about the great privilege it is to make music with your friends. And that they had, and the next song was dedicated to a friend of theirs. It's been a huge influence on them. And they played this song called Hixon. And I was on the loo and I nearly fell out of the porter loo and I ran to the front of the stage and I bawled my eyes out. But they played a song about me and it's like, you make a band, you made a family, we're all Hixon's kids. And my jaw was on the floor, in front of 25,000 people. they dropped this bombshell on me.
That was one you'll never forget.
Never forget it. Yeah. They haven't released it yet, though, so you can't hear it. But
I'm sure it's brilliant.
It is, yeah.
You get a huge amount of praise, you know, in the press. Financial Times rave about you and your work. The Guardian, you know, 5 stars for projects that you've done, including one with Cillian Murphy. How does that feel? Is that something that's a source of personal pride for you, particularly having taken the chances and the risks that you did to pursue your own interests and your own passion?
Honestly, it horrifies me. I remember the Financial Times piece. I remember Joe Ellison ringing, and it took months and months and months of, like, you know, research and discussions, and I was so anxious. And even today, being on here with you, like, I'm actually dying over here. Like, I hate talking about myself, I hate reading about myself, but the Financial Times piece hit, and I couldn't look at it. I couldn't read it. I just said to my husband, like, is it okay? And it was maybe 6 or 7 weeks later, myself and Cillian and Max Porter went away for a few days together just to have a break and a breath. And we, you know, Max read Shy to Cillian and I for the first time, and Cillian was preparing for Oppenheimer. We had this whole thing where he was holding the pipe wrong, and we were showing him how to hold the pipe. And then they were like, we've both had our moment. And I'm like, what? And Cillian produces the Financial Times. He's like, read it. He said, go and sit down there in the corner now and read it. You have to read it. And I was in bits. I was in apps. I was shaking. I was crying. It's such a, you know, but when it's 5 stars in The Guardian for, like, or The New York Times for a piece that I've produced, I have great pride in that. And that's a really big deal. And I love the fact that, like, the artists get that kind of praise and the work gets that kind of praise. That I can stomach that really easy. But when it comes to talking about myself, oh, it's horrific.
Horrific.
Horrific. It's my worst nightmare, Richard. Like, I actually can't believe the girls convinced me to do this. Like, I woke up this morning going, how in the name of God did this happen?
Well, we're delighted that they did. Mary Hixon, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you.